not only in Fairbanks and Anchorage, but in little bitty communities. Ketchikan had one going, and villages have them going. And the same thing is developed in other areas. There are elder task forces and working groups all over the state. People come together, and we're doing the same in the department, basically. We are putting a heavy focus on directors communicating regularly with each other and on that sharing what it is we're doing so that we avoid feeding into oversimplistic solutions. I rely very heavily on the community, and it will be a long process the remainder of this year figuring out what the cuts in preventive services grants and block grants do and how that should be realigned. I suspect that that will be the subject of a lot of work in the governor's office on prior to the revisions. And the governor's very clear that was the first budget and the result of not a lot of time to make fine distinctions.
Thank you. I would like to remind the audience if there is anyone who came in without signing the witness register, we need to get need to ask you to do that so we can get a better count of how many people we have to hear from on the other items before us. I'd like to limit committee members to one question so we can get through the number here. Representative Phillips, we'll try and get back to you too if you have more than one, I suppose.
Well, Neil's got one, but I this is a general Phillips. It'll make a Reader's Digest version, okay? We're running out of time here. I just wanted to find out your general philosophy in regards to your department, the role of government in people's lives. Now, I come from a community that basically believes that government should only do what people cannot do for themselves. That's deeply rooted, at least in the communities that I represent. So I'll just preface my question with that statement. I just want to find out what your thoughts are as far as the role of government is concerned to society.
I don't think I disagree with that. I think to a large extent the government does only do what people can't do for themselves. The fact is that, I think that really is true, that the feelings about being on public assistance run so strong in this society that when someone's on public assistance, I'm inclined to believe they have to be. And to the extent there's fraud, it's no different than fraud in an agricultural loan program or fraud in how a state employee uses their per diem or from embezzlement from a private corporation. It's a crime. But it's not welfare, it shouldn't brand other welfare recipients. People who receive assistance generally need it because they're all having to overcome enormous burdens to go ask for it. When we intervene with an abused or neglected child, in fact, it is almost always because the family and the close community, the church and the school and other people around that family have been unable to intervene. And the reports frequently come from people who are part of that network very close.
Well, let me just give you an example. I mean, you're talking one
minute,
John. Okay, so I'm just going to give you one example where government does interfere with private individuals as far as trying to help one another within the community.
Okay.
We have an alliance club that was trying to make these baskets, fruit, and toys, and everything else for these welfare people. Yeah, public assistance came in and said, oh, we can't do that. We can't reveal the names. All right? We finally worked it out, but I made about a half a dozen calls down here, and thumped on the commissioner at that time and said, hey, you know, here's a group of people, private individuals, not costing anything, wanting to help people who are in need in the community. So, and that really galled me, you know, and it galled my constituents where they did of their own goodness, of their own heart, to try to help people, and here something comes in because there's some federal regulation or state regulation preventing them from helping themselves. That's why I asked the question.
Okay, let me turn it around just a moment, though. If the Lions Club in that event wanted to give help to people who needed, folks, I presume, could have let them know they needed that. It would have been, in my opinion, more of a government intervention and an unwarranted one to hand out the names without the permission of the recipient, because in a sense that would have intervened in their life in a very substantial way, making their needs very public. Aside from personally believing that, but it's
no,
a federal law.
Wait a minute. Just one piece of information that the Lions Club could care less who the names were. What they wanted to do is sign a number to the package so it goes to the recipient. Okay, that was the problem. And the public says, well, we can't do that because of privacy and this, that, and the other thing. I went around and around Anchorage. We finally got it worked out. But I don't think we
suggesting that folks in the department got obsessive about confidentiality.
Yes, they sure did.
And didn't come up with a very quick solution very quickly. I can't deny that that happens sometimes. Things get overly complicated almost everywhere, and I agree with you. We ought to be able to make simple solutions.
And I'm telling you, the people of Lions Club care less about who the individual people. They wanted to take care of those in real true need.
Okay.
So, anyway, I'm finished.
Representative Hudson.
Commissioner, I've observed several commissioners of health, education, and social services, and many of them start out well-meaning and become victims of a system in which they're there to administer. And I'd like to home in on the word administration, because I think that that's been one of the fallings, one of the failings of most of the administrations I've observed. It becomes a protective thing to protect the existing divisions and delivery systems of much needed services. And I guess my, first of all, I guess I'd like to preface this thing by saying that I'm really pleased that you're bringing some good news forward. And I think that's part of the problem in our society, is that we concentrate so much on the doom and gloom and how everything's going to hell in a hand bucket there. And we really definitely need to start looking for the measurable improvements that we've had in here. So I'd like to see you concentrate on really reducing your administrative overhead to the greatest extent. And if that means privatization or performing services at the municipal level or the local level, at the expense of dismantling some state agencies that are delivering services, then it should be done. I'd like to see you take a look at what I think are programs that are successful, like the Older Alaskans Commission. There you have the older Alaskans themselves administering grants where they feel that it's most proper. Not that they always do the best job or that it wasn't done well before, but it suddenly puts the decisions into the hands of the people that are going to receive the services, and I think that's a good thing. And then I'd like to see you also highlight, in addition to your good news, on the pride and self-sufficiency factors, because I think those are things that bring people up out of the miseries and into the mainstream. And then I guess maybe finally, this is all one. I'm going to ask a question, please.
Roll the drum.
I haven't asked a question yet. I also believe that we're so busy fighting the war that we haven't got the peace negotiations going at the conference table. We've got all of our forces out on the front lines. We're fighting detox. We're fighting child abuse. People battering their children off the walls and beating up on their wives and husbands and kids and things of this nature there. And probably substance abuse can probably be blamed for some of the major expenses of government. And it's an area that I have a deep personal commitment to do something about. And I think education is the key. So I'd like to see health, education, and social services really get together with education. And I mean really get together. And I'd like to see some priorities to begin to stop the flow of that. And my question is, what do you feel is the current AIDS problem in the state of Alaska, and what are you going to do about it?
I don't have the slightest idea what the extent of the problem of AIDS is. Elizabeth Ward's here from Public Health, and she probably could answer that. I'll tell you what, the little teeny piece that I do know about AIDS, I stopped at the Fairbanks Health Center and talked to the public health nursing people while I was trying to get my house packed and clean up things at the AG's office before I came to Juneau. And when I talked to the person there responsible for sexually transmitted diseases and those kinds of things, what I was told is they're having a remarkable rate of people willingly coming in for AIDS screening and for counseling regarding that, and that they have structured their program. This is labor intensive. It's more labor intensive than it would be simply to take a test and send the people out the door. They have structured it very deliberately to try to create an opportunity for counseling for each person who feels that they might need this screening at each opportunity. And that's a piece of what's being done about it in the state of Alaska. Sorry to interrupt, Elizabeth can probably answer that better.
And could I ask if I might, we may need to hold that until we have the division overviews, and we could also ask staff to contact John Middell, the state's epidemiologist, for a some kind of written report or otherwise regarding that. Would that be satisfactory? And next on the list is Representative Hanley, followed by Representative Conley.
Thank you. Ms. Chan, Commissioner, I'm just interested in what you were talking about balance. And I guess I began thinking about the daycare. I think we're putting $2.7 million or something, that the governor talked about a very substantial increase in daycare. And I recognize there was a need because we had teleconference last summer and talked about the waiting list and so forth. But thinking about that and thinking about the zeroing out of the block grants, I guess I'm wondering if the balance is there. Granted, maybe some of those block grants, thinking about government only doing those things, and I know Boy Scouts and Boys Club, and so maybe the private sector needs to pick up more of those. I think we're still giving everybody the permanent fund, and we have to let people know that they have to assume more responsibility. But I am concerned, because I was impressed with that block grant process, having observed it in the screening and the prioritization that takes place in that process. So to zero that out, I mean, to put this huge chunk of money into daycare, and then to zero out Fairbanks and Anchorage block grants, I'm concerned that maybe that balance isn't there. So hopefully we'll have more dialogue, you know, and maybe, I was pleased that you said that maybe the budget hasn't been fine-tuned, and the governor indicated that as well. So I appreciate his concern for daycare. I think we all have that concern, but I'm also concerned about some of the other services, and hopefully we can strike a little bit better balance when we come up with the final budget.
Well, I have to echo Representative Hanlon's remarks. I think you're beginning to see just how strong the support for the block grant is, just because, you know, the leanness and the delivery of service, the kind of return we get on our state investment through those private nonprofits, those service providers, is enormous. I know you have a good sense of that, and
right.
We're going to keep communicating that to you just as strongly as we can. I think there's a growing consensus here in the committee. Representative Donnelly.
Commissioner, you mentioned the complex interrelationship of programs and clients of the department. And one of the things the department's been working on for the past several years was developing a case management system to be computerized and increase the efficiency of the people who are working on those cases and be able to cross-reference who else was doing what. To my knowledge, that was one of the first things that was cut in the budget last year, just at the point where it was about to be implemented. And when we do have our departmental overviews, I'd like you to be prepared to discuss, or have your staff prepared to discuss, the pros and cons of maybe cutting in other areas so that we can get that system implemented so we can be more efficient in what we have in the future.
You're referring to the case management information system for family use services?
Yeah, that's correct.
At each of the divisions, almost every unit of the department is working on some sort of information system development or has gotten something in place. The biggest one going on right now in the department is with Medicaid.
And the real issue here is, do we keep things going the way they are at the present level, or do we have to make cuts in the present level to get these systems online so we can be more efficient with what we have?
Again, Representative Boyer?
He left.
Representative Phillips, did you have one more quick question?
Well, it's not the illness. Alex hit the one I was going to ask. The other one was, I'm not going to ask the question, but I think there's got to be a better relationship between your department Foster Care Association, either that private, nonprofit organization that's doing this, they want to do it, by and large. I know a few cases are abuses of the thing, and I just want to emphasize that.
Commissioner, thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
You get one of my questions I was in here, but he limited me to one.
I'm sorry. I had to do that.
Use the chair.
Things may have gotten out of hand. I'd like to let the committee know that now House Bill 53 is before us for the first time. We'd like to call Dr. Annette Thorne forward. If she would please to give testimony.
Sure.
Dr. Thorne, would you come forward, please? And Representative Kopanen would like to make some comments and pose some questions for you.
Essentially, I asked Dr. Thorne here to answer some questions or bring up some facts in regard to the program. I'd like to introduce House Bill 53. Your packet contains a copy of the bill, the position paper, which I'm going to read part of, the current Alaska statute in regard, and the Washington State statute, which was passed recently, which increased penalties in that state. Other states have done likewise, but we haven't received all of the material. Alaska Statute 1860-010, dealing with occupational safety and health, have have an intent stating that personal injuries and illnesses arising out of work situations pose a substantial burden upon and are a hindrance to the people of the state in terms of loss of production, wage loss, medical expense, and disability compensation payments. And as you know, there has been considerable pressure upon health insurance programs due to this, and also in the workman's compensation area. We are being pressured to do something about the increased cost of workman's comp. We have one of the highest occupational injury and illness rates in the country. I believe at this point we rank third per capita in the country, which I will ask, in fact, without interrupting, that would be the first thing you would speak to, is where do we stand in regard to that. And therefore, I think it is incumbent on us to reduce that rate. We are essentially trying to bring the rate down, and I think the necessary part of that is to bring two various employers and their intermediate level personnel, foremen and the like, an acknowledgement we feel that this is fairly serious. One of the incidents that brought this to my mind was a Clear Air Force base where six workers worked inside of the radar dome when the radar dome was turned on. There's nothing wrong with the equipment that anyone ascertained. It was just a procedural error on the part, essentially, I would say, of the foreman of the project. These people who were in there, essentially, it was the same thing as being inside of an oven and being partially baked. Many of them are developing cataracts, which is a very common problem with that particular kind of radiation. The white of your eyes coagulate just as well as an egg. It's grief when subjected to that particular radiation wavelength. Nerve injury, pain, other kinds of things. The total fine for this was $400. That's a little over $400, which is an absurd low level. Current Alaska statute, the penalty for a serious workplace violation, this is one that could possibly project, is a maximum fine of $1,000. There is then an adjustment applied to that, a whole number of factors, which again I will ask Dr. Thorne to explain. So the adjusted average fine for a serious violation in the past year has been $175. One of the points is that the this structure, this fine structure, this statute has been in place for 17 years when inflation has gone up and other things without any modification. And looking at the incidence of injury and the incidence of compliance, and apparently the rate of injury and illness, looking at the statistics, fell to about 1980 and it has increased since. In other words, based on that particular shallow evidence, one would say that there is not the deterrent effect on the statute worked until about 1980, and in the past 7 years has been less and less effective. The bill would increase the maximum fine to $25,000. If you apply the existing formula, that would mean that the actual average fine would be $4,375. In Washington state, the equivalent violation now carries a maximum fine of $5,000. In the case, when you look at the statute, you'll notice that in the case where there was willful, repeated violation, that results in a death, not may result in a death, but actually a death has resulted when there have been a number of violations that have been called to the attention of the employer, and they have not been taken care of, then the fine is increased to over $100,000. Now, it is true that we can proceed through criminal law in that case, and the state of Illinois did in the case of the worker who died of cyanide poison. In fact, in that case, it wasn't even willful, but it wasn't repeated. In other words, the attention hadn't been called quite to the same extent that this was required. Texas, and they did convict and incarcerate the officials of the firm involved. Texas and a number of other states have got a procedure called rollout, where if there is an industrial accident or resulting in death or the county prosecutors and a criminal investigation team in the investigation. This sounds quite possible, but I don't think in the current situation in Alaska that we can redirect our, you know, set up yet another unit in public safety or in Department of Law for this purpose. So I think that having a civil penalty is one additional way of calling the attention of the employer and his foreman and similar personnel to the fact that we're serious about this. There is no particular reason why this duty, which is a common law duty, provides for a safe workplace, cannot be taken care of. There will be an increase in administrative costs because I expect there will be a rush to comply. But perhaps we'll be fine without, you know. Dr. Thorne, introduce yourself and your office.
I'm Dr. Annette Thorne. I'm the Medical Director of Occupational Health and Safety. And I'm here today to speak to the department and basically let you know that the department supports the going concept, that we need to take a look at the implications and the possible impact on the OSHA program, and that will be reflected in the position paper, which will be forthcoming. We see a real need for this bill for several reasons, one of which is that the adjustment for inflation has not occurred in the past 17 years since the fine structure was originally set up when the OSHA Act was introduced. The other factor is with this present economic downturn in the state, there is an increased impetus at the worksite to cut corners on health and safety. Every available means of cutting costs for production are being utilized, and there is a serious concern that increase in fatality rate in Alaska may, in fact, be a result of the economic problems of the state. So that this is a time when the department is in a position where we have to support this bill. The implications of the program, however, we cannot tell you yet. We're looking at entering analysis on what the costs and so on will be. As to the issue that you brought up as to where Alaska fits in terms of its occupationally induced injury and illness rate in the country, we have continued to be second or third highest in the country. Even when you adjust for the fact that we have a preponderance of high hazard industries like oil drilling, logging, pulp mills, and so on, even if you compare those industries in this state with those industries nationwide, where it's still very high. A lot of this may have to do with short production seasons, human factors. People work very, very long hours during short production seasons, especially in food processing and so on. But it seems that we really have a problem that needs to be addressed, and the deterrent effect of increasing the penalty may, in fact, be beneficial in protecting the health of the workers. This is the concern, that the overall reason for the existence of OSHA is to decrease the injury and illness rate before it occurs. Occupational injuries and illnesses, by and large, are not treatable. Anyone knows if you've already got asbestosis, there's no medicine that will take it away from you. If you've lost your hand, there's nothing that can give it back to you. So that the real impact on workers' health and productivity isn't prevention. And the deterrent effect of the bill is hoped to have an effect on this high incident.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? I believe Representative Phillips has one.
Well, it's fine to compare this state to the other states in the country. But I'm also curious, how do we stack up, say, with the Scandinavian countries?
Oh.
I mean, we're all in northern climates. I mean, you know, it's hard enough to walk across the street without, you know, falling down. If you're in the south, you don't have to worry about it too much.
Right,
so,
we have cold factors and so on. We stack up very, very poorly.
And maybe we ought to look at what they're doing.
Part of that is financing. They put a high priority on research and intervention in occupational health and safety. They have, whereas we have one physician working in this area, they have, for a country, for example, in Finland, that is much, perhaps the same state as Wisconsin population, to give you an idea. They that these processes become non-damaging when workers do not become ill or do not become injured. So in comparison, the U.S. as a whole is far behind Scandinavian, Finnish, Danish countries.
Representative Kroger.
Dr. Thorne, are there going to be other witnesses who are testifying?
I don't believe so.
Okay. If this is not within your area of expertise, just tell me. I did have. With respect to a similar type of situation in the antitrust area, one of the ways that our society and the federal government has crafted their statutes is designed to reduce the cost of enforcement and increase the penalties. And that is rather than by a series of civil penalties, which have to be enforced by the state, they have trebled the damages. That's generally enforced by private parties, private litigants, as private attorneys general. And that would be a way of increasing the deterrent effect here, which is your interest, and lowering the state cost, which is also something you mentioned here. And it would, in fact, ensure that the injured claimant receives adequate compensation. In our tort reform bill, Senate Bill 377, we passed last year, they required that punitive damages be supported by clear and convincing evidence. Generally, in something like this, if you violate the statute, that is negligence per se under the law. And you don't have to show any additional form of negligence. And I'm wondering if you would have any comment or if you would care to respond in writing. Rather than upping the civil penalties, which will carry a substantial fiscal note possibly, providing a civil remedy of treble damages.
Well, the only difficulty I see there is that workers do not have a right to sue their employers for personal injury. They have a right to workers' compensation. Back in the 1930s, on a national level, a decision was made to trade off the right to sue the employer for negligent exposure and resultant injury for guaranteed compensation for injury that did occur. So workers' compensation is the sole remedy, and an employee cannot sue their employer. So unless you could find a way around that difficulty, I think it would be, not being a lawyer, might be very difficult.
Well, couldn't that simply be an amendment to the workers' comp statute?
I don't think that it's
if there's a repeated or willful violation in an egregious case, why couldn't that simply be plugged into that system?
I would have to find out where the sole remedy clause is incorporated into the law.
I'm not talking about changing the remedy. I'm simply talking about upping the penalty.
The difficulty also, I think the reason that the sole remedy was created and is standard throughout the country is because litigation is very expensive. It's very difficult for workers to find lawyers who will represent them in these kinds of cases. It might be a different environment now in the 80s than it was in the 30s because there's the contingency fees of structure and so on.
There is under the workers' comp a schedule. The attorney is paid a set schedule. It's not a third. It's usually 10%. But it seems to me, if you're talking about an enforcement mechanism, you have a ready enforcement mechanism already, because in each one of these cases, there's going to be a workers' comp claim.
The problem, Representative, with the workers' comp system is that it's a very cheap system for the employer. They pay a certain workers' comp insurance premium, and what that guarantees them is coverage for a certain percentage of the lost time the person is away from, person is permanently disabled, and it provides them with the medical payments and something on the order of $8,000 for a lost eye. And there is no pain and suffering, there's no punitive damages, and that is the limitation to the system. Workers' comp compensation is much, much lower than would be ever granted in civil court.
How about alternatively providing, if you're concerned about reducing the fiscal note here, providing specifically in statute that the civil penalty can be enforced by private attorney general?
That would be a great, if you were to uncover the employer and say that they are open to civil suit from their own employees.
I'm not necessarily even talking about standing in the shoes of the employee, but providing specifically in something like this. If we're concerned, what I'm concerned about is the impediment you touched on in your direct testimony, that this will carry a fiscal note, and you don't know how much it's going to be. I'm trying to think of a way to reduce or eliminate that fiscal note. And one way that could be done would be to encourage private suits, which would not cost the state anything and simply would be taken out of the recovery, with the balance going to the state, thereby reducing or eliminating the fiscal note entirely.
I think that's a very interesting idea. However, the concern for the fiscal note may be counterbalanced by slightly increased revenues from the increased penalties. So that the increased penalties will probably cover the costs of the kind of costs we're looking at, is that there will probably be an increased rate of contest by employers. The general rule of thumb with the penalties is for $60 up to $400, most employers do not contest. Over $1,000 they do. So that the contest rate is expected to increase. Attorney's fees and the administrative staff may need to increase slightly. The other thing is that there will probably be an increase in requests for voluntary compliance, which is a service offered by OSHA. When an employer requests help, OSHA can go out, send an inspector, and tell them what they need to fix without an accompanying fine. Those services are likely to increase. So those are the kinds of services. It's not expected to be a high fiscal.
Thank you. Representative Cochran has a brief comment.
I just want to call to the attention committee. The next committee of referral is Judiciary, which would be looking at these aspects of it, and we are in the science
system. Yes. Hey, thank you. Representative Hudson, do you have a quick question?
Quick question, I guess, is what were the costs in the last full fiscal year for the enforcement of the laws that currently exist, and what were your general findings, and what kind of monies were come back to the state or come back as a result of penalties?
I can only answer half of that question because I do not administrate the OSHA program. I can't tell you what the overall cost of the program is. Half of the funding for the OSHA program does come from the federal government because we're in a cooperative agreement with the federal government to cover OSHA. So I think it's on the order of about $1 million. But I'm not sure. The other question you're asking is what are the proceeds from the penalties that we're currently getting? And they're on the order of $60,000 a year.
$60,000,
I believe.
Yes, $60,000.
Cost about $1 million to administer?
Yes.
Thank you. Dr. Thor, thank you for being here. I'm sorry to rush things through. I'd remind the committee that the bill will be again before us on Thursday with the fiscal note, we hope, and some other backup materials from the department. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If there's no objection from the committee, I'd like to change the order of our executive orders on the calendar this morning. We have two persons here to testify regarding executive order number 67, the transfer of responsibility for analyzing breathalyzer tests from DHNSS to the Department of Public Safety. I'd like to ask James Vaden to come forward, please, at this time. I'd like to ask him to limit his comments so we can get through this. If you go right ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Our committee members, good morning. My name is James Vaden. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. This executive order would transfer the certification of the breathalyzer program from Health and Social Services over to the Department of Public Safety. We've requested this for a variety of reasons, and we believe that it can be done within public safety because of funding which we received several years ago from the legislature to open up a state forensic crime laboratory. They presently have the capability to do the testing on the perchlorate tubes and also to administer this program. George Taft, who's the director of our laboratory, came from Texas where he administered a similar program for 20 years. It's very important that there be a good administrative program for the intoximeter because of the penalties which are presently invoked by law against individuals that are accused of a variety of crimes. It creates a tremendous problem for the Department of Law when an officer comes in and suddenly in court you find out that the instrument that he used had not been calibrated or certified for a certain period of time, or that officer's certification had lapsed. We would like to assist the Department of Law in end the fragmentation of this program. basically begins to break down because no one follows through on the program to ascertain that the instruments are continually certified or that the officers are continuing their certification. Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Just a brief one. Referring to Governor Cooper's letter of transmittal dated January 19, bottom of page 3, final paragraph, suggests a statutory change to AS 2935033 that the existing title only refers to chemical analyses of blood. This suggests that it also refers to chemical analysis of breath, reflecting the use of the breathalyzer. Is the administration planning to introduce such a bill?
That would have to be answered by the Department of Law.
I see. I was wondering if Ms. Kravitz could answer that.
Representative Mr. Chairman, Gail Horesky from the Department of Law, that does not need to be done by a bill. Actually, Art Peterson just stuck this in the transmittal letter to let you people know that that was going to occur. That's a kind of a change that the advisor of statute would do in his yearly, you know how they have that advisor
statute. Should we look for that this year?
I can double check. I assume it will be.
Would you please? Thank you.
Representative Phillips, do you have a question?
A quick comment. That's the point I was trying to make the other day about the EOs. You know, I think it's the legislature's responsibility to watch out for statutory changes by the state. This is it.
Thank you. Any further questions, Mr. Davey?
Does the Department of Health and Social Services willing to give this to you now without a fight?
I can speak to that.
Okay.
Simple yes or no. Are they yes? Okay.
Thank you.
Just a comment, and that is that it's a... If the transfer is to transfer the functions, that is the duties, without the people, it seems to me as though it's a decision on the part of the Department of Health and Social Services to give away the responsibilities, but to, basically speaking, not the added person that you have. I notice you've got an increased fiscal note from $54,000 to $80,000. It seems to me as though the position ought to go along with it, and the Department of Health and Social Services should find that relief in other areas.
Bill? Could I ask Ms. Horesky to please come forward? Could you state your name again and reference for the record, please?
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gail Horesky. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Law, Criminal Division. I am here to speak in support of this executive order. As you know, our division administers the district attorneys. We have 14 DA's offices statewide, and we handle most of the prosecutions for drunk driving in the state of Alaska. In Anchorage, there is a municipal prosecution and other small places occasionally, but speaking in the main, we do almost all of the DWI prosecutions. The reason that this bill was suggested, it did start as a bill and then was ultimately converted to executive order, was because of the tremendous problem we have had in the past in specific DWI prosecutions and in class actions. There's one pending in the Fairbanks right now with about 75 cases have been tied up for about 3 years now, where there are challenges to the methodology or a specific type of training or a specific hardware that's being used. And we have just found that it's an administrative nightmare where the statutes say the Department of Health and Social Services will be responsible for certain functions, but in reality and historically, the Department of Public Safety has performed most of those functions, such as training, such as purchasing the instruments, such as the routine maintenance kind of thing. It would make administrative sense and, I think, in the long run, save money for the state to consolidate those duties in a central place, have someone who's qualified, as Dr. Chass certainly is, to oversee the program, to use the chemists and the expertise and the equipment that's now available in this sophisticated crime lab up in Anchorage, and consequently also lessen our headaches when we go in and have to defend legal challenges to a system that's somewhat fragmented.
Are there questions? No, we're not seeing a motion.
I have a question. Is there anybody from the Public Defender's Office?
I don't believe so. But for the committee's information, again, the executive order will be before us again on Wednesday. And the motion will be in order at that time. Thank you, Ms. Horesky. If I could ask Ms. Ward, who answered a question a moment ago, to state her name and affiliation for the record.
The commissioner had to return. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Elizabeth Ward, Director of Public Health. We are in agreement with this executive order. I agree with the fragmentation that has occurred. I've had the pleasure of seeing myself last week, the crime lab in Anchorage. I agree it's a very fine facility. They should be taking over this function. The difficulty in the fiscal note is only in terms of clerical support. We agree that the chemists should be transferred. What we have not been what we do disagree on is giving up clerical support that we feel doesn't exist. We have, during the 70s, we in fact, during the 70s, we've been able to document, we in fact got some money from public safety through an RSA. As usual, those RSAs disappeared. We have assumed those responsibilities for that position into our other clerical work. And in fact, the laboratory here in Southeast where that chemist is located, because of FY87 reductions and our FY88 budget is being closed, there are no clerical supports starting July 1 that can be transferred. Those positions are being eliminated. The chemist is expected to be transferred to Anchorage and will become part of public safety's program.
Are there any questions?
I have a comment, and that is that I'm generally very supportive of the idea of moving the breath and blood tests into public safety. But again, I've been around the other side of the fence so long that I realized how these things work, and I would strongly suggest that the positions go with the responsibilities.
Yes, we agree with the chemist going. That's the position that is funded for that program.
Great, thank you. Mm-hmm. Is there anyone else here to testify on this executive order? As I mentioned, a motion will be in order on Wednesday when we take this up again. I'd like to move now to Executive Order Number 63, the transfer of the Alaska Historical Commission from DOE to DNR. Our 10 o'clock ending time and take care of this. That's all right with everyone.
Just a moment, please. He is
out of the office at this time. He is.
So
okay. We'll talk to him about being before us on, well, actually, does anyone anticipate any questions?
Just a moment.
Any opposition?
That's
verbally? No, I mean, to a letter?
No, we've received nothing. Are there any plans? Any members of the committee to submit anything in writing regarding this executive order? If not, I'll entertain a motion at this time.
Is that what you want?
No,
regarding
the executive order.
Why don't we
we don't have to act. We'll just leave it for Wednesday along with 67 if anyone comes up with anything.
I will have some questions.
You will, okay. I'd like to announce that as I said before, division presentations will be before us on Wednesday, as well as these executive orders. We'll meet again Wednesday morning at 8:30. And I'd like to adjourn this meeting in the House.
Let's talk to
Katie.
Okay.
At 10 o'clock.
On the nose.
Come out of
film.
Come out of film. It could be.